This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, home attendants demand their stolen wages and an end to mandatory 24-hour shifts. But first, the prevalence of racism in the labor market and what is to be done.
Well, the so-called recovery of the U.S. economy has not been equally kind, no it hasn't, to everyone. Even as the unemployment rate generally has decreased, the unemployment rate for African Americans is currently more than twice as high as that for white Americans.
Indeed, nationwide in 2015, 9.6% of African Americans were unemployed, compared with 4.6% of whites. This 2-to-1 ratio of African Americans to white unemployment has persisted for at least the last 50 years. This unemployment gap is not one because of skill or education. It is because of the very real and persistent discrimination prevalent in the U.S. labor market.
Did you know that it would take 228 years for African American families to amass the wealth of white families? Well, we're joined now by William Spriggs, chief economist of the AFL-CIO and professor in and former chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. And Bill was also former assistant secretary of the Office of Policy at the United States Department of Labor. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bill, I want to get into the unemployment situation because it seems as if people sort of expect that the African-American unemployment rate will be twice the white rate and that people don't question it anymore. This is the way it is. It's like this is almost normal. And this has been going on since Dr. King was talking about it in 1967 and before that. Is this a result of discrimination? Is there something in the labor market that's forcing this? Is there something we can do about it?
Well, the labor markets have a huge amount of discrimination in them. And we know there's a huge undercurrent of discrimination, just built-in bias in our system. Look at the 30% hardcore polling that Donald Trump gets. The bulk of it just because he openly says things that are racist. This is a reality we have to understand goes over to the labor market and the way that people view job applicants. And so if you're going to face a constant drumbeat of about 30% of employers not wanting to hire, then you're going to find that blacks are going to find it much harder to get jobs, and you're going to get a phenomenon where no matter who you put in front of them, skilled, unskilled, well-educated, less educated, you're going to find that the system isn't going to work properly. What we do see over the course of our recessions and then employment booms is that when the employment booms come towards their end and we have a lot fewer people looking per job opening, that the level of discrimination falls. So when the labor market is really slack, blacks who are much better educated than whites have much higher unemployment rates. Most of this downturn since the Great Recession, blacks with associate degrees had unemployment rates that were higher than white high school dropouts. Blacks with an associate's degree had higher unemployment rates than white high school dropouts. Now that the labor market has had 78 straight months of job growth, and we're finally getting to the point where job lookers per job opening is getting tighter, blacks with associate degrees have a lower unemployment rate than white high school dropouts, and they're now pretty much on par with white high school graduates. If we let the labor market continue to tighten, then that's going to improve. But invariably, when we get really close, the Federal Reserve thinks the labor market is at full employment. They raise interest rates. The labor market slows down, and black people start losing jobs. And we never get to parity. What also happens is that when the labor market gets better, then blacks with less education who give up because their unemployment rates are too high finally come into the labor market. So the black unemployment rate is sensitive to how well the labor market performs, and so the black line gets longer when the labor market improves because people who are discouraged finally come back in and start looking, and that's what's been happening over the last couple of months. In fact, since the recovery, the black employment-to-population ratio has gone up over 10%. A lot of people have ignored this because they look at the 2-to-1 unemployment rate, but the share of blacks working has actually been going up. For whites, it hasn't changed very much because white labor force participation has stayed about the same. And so the share of whites employed has only gone up a tiny amount, whereas for blacks it's gone up a very substantial amount. So tight labor markets do make a difference. They do lower market discrimination. They do make it easier for blacks to find jobs. But the anomaly you can see clearly in the data, the old adage, blacks have to be twice as good, and that's what shows up in the data. You have to have the associate's degree, you have to be twice as good in order to get the unemployment rate of a white person who's less educated. And until we shake discrimination out of the labor market, that's not going to change. And what that does is, of course, that when blacks do get jobs, two things. One, blacks know that they have a much higher chance of being unemployed, so they're much willing to take lower-wage jobs. And once blacks are employed, we also see that blacks don't quit. And quit rates are a helpful way for people to get higher wages. But blacks are very reticent to quit because it's just too hard to find a job.
You know, what I was thinking about was the kind of intersectionality that, for example, people from the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the first and indeed the second one, or even the Black Panther Party's 10-point platform, they talked about the economic demands along with demands for racial justice as kind of a dual agenda of black freedom movements. So I was thinking about the Eric Garner situation and blacks being forced into the underground economy because of the discrimination in the job market as one way of understanding the additional pressure and tension that they face with the policing apparatus. So with that, is there that... Are we still about, and should we kind of make sure that our demands for the rectification of the discrimination and so on inherently include a kind of social justice, racial justice component along with economic policy that is specific to the needs of the African American community?
Well, yes, it has to be. It has to address this level of discrimination because it hurts everyone. When the Federal Reserve thinks we're at full employment, but black people with associate degrees are facing the labor market that whites who are dropouts face, that's not full employment. That's not letting wages rise. When there are unemployed, skilled unemployed workers on the sideline, employers keep wages down because they know they can go get somebody else for less. And that hurts everyone. So we have to have a vision of economic justice that does not allow for this level of discrimination in the labor market. But more than that, again, in the case of Eric Garner, if people can watch a video of someone being arrested in New York over taxes on cigarettes and see the level of police force put to play, while HSBC Bank, the huge European bank that got convicted of laundering 800 and some million dollars worth of drug money, no police showed up, not a single one. So if the police are going to show up in force for someone who cheated on cigarette tax, but they're not going to show up on people who laundered over $800 million worth of drug money, then, you know, how are we to think this is a just society? And if jurors can watch that video and see someone beg for their life and be killed over cigarette taxes, and then their answer is, I mean, that's really was their response. Like the police killed a cockroach. Then you can't believe that those same jurors, when they would get a job application from a black person, could treat them fairly. They didn't think that Eric Garner deserved to live, so they clearly can't think you deserve a job. So I think of the connection more in terms of what it says about our sense of justice. And the complaint in the South was that police knew that they could do this and nothing would happen to them, that black lives had no value, that no one had to be held accountable for actions that took away black lives. And economics is a way to take away lives. The unemployment rate for black high school dropouts is violence against the black community. That unemployment rate is not the unemployment rate of any other set of high school dropouts. Any. It's not close. That's economic violence.
So how do we deal as a society with that economic violence? Is there a legal mechanism? Are there targeted programs? What is to be done?
Well, I think we have to get more serious about it. We have to have testers in the labor market, as was the case with housing. That's the way we detect discrimination in housing. And for high school educated workers and for high school dropouts in particular, these are jobs which presumably many people would qualify for. They're not requiring computer skills at a high level. And so we should have testers out to see what our employers doing. Are they discriminating? It is against the law. The whole point of the March on Washington was because President Kennedy, in proposing his Civil Rights Act, had left out the key provision on ending discrimination in employment. And John Lewis was going to be censored in his speech because he was attacking that part of Kennedy's bill. They asked him to tone it down a little bit. Don't go after President Kennedy too hard. Lewis still criticized the president, just not as hard as he had in his original draft. But that was the victory of the march, was to say we must end employment discrimination. And Title VII, the creation of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to attempt to give some teeth to it, had impact, at least in the public sector. We know that discrimination in the public sector reduced dramatically after the Civil Rights Act passed, and it was one of the key reasons why black poverty fell, because we were able to have the Justice Department go after fire departments, police departments, city hospitals, sanitation jobs, and find entryways for black workers into that arena. And then we had the minimum wage applied to those public sector jobs, which at the time, if you made the minimum wage, you couldn't be poor, because if you worked full-time at the minimum wage back then, at least you could support yourself. So these were real victories. But in the private sector, we have lagged behind. And so many jobs are in the private sector, that level of discrimination remains.
Bill, would a federal, these are some of the proposals that have come out of a document put together by M4BL, Black Lives Matter, and they were talking about federal and state jobs programs, the right for workers to organize, and reparations for past harms as economic reforms fundamentally. Do they, and would these things materially change the conditions in black communities as you see it?
A huge problem for the black community is the lack of wealth. And there's no serious way to close the racial wealth divide without having somewhere on the table a discussion of reparations, because the accumulated effect of discrimination in the labor market, discrimination in the housing market, access to higher education, those accumulated over years. And so you cannot expect in a short window to erase that. Some people have put out that would take about 200 years. That's not workable, and it's not meaningful for the nation, because we know that so many things connected to wealth make a difference. The vitality of our cities and their tax base. Baltimore would look different. Detroit would look different if blacks had the same level of home ownership and the same level of wealth. The tax base would look that different. You know, there are huge sections of New York that would look different. So it hurts everyone that these revenues aren't present because of that wealth gap. So somewhere on the table, some discussion has to be about what do we do about this wealth gap in a serious way. But going forward, the gap needs to close, and the gap can only close if we don't have discrimination in the labor market, if we don't make mistakes about the way we try and make college affordable, if we can correct what's going on now in the housing market, where the banks are using standards, not pre-bubble, but higher standards that aren't necessary, that seem to be locking out black and Latino homeowners from recovering from all the damage done to them by the banks in the run-up to the crisis.
We want to thank you for being with us and sharing some of your thoughts. You're always insightful and helpful in understanding the particularities of discrimination against the African-American community, the wealth disparities, and ideas about what is to be done for real job programs and the creation of wealth. We've been speaking with William Spriggs, who serves as chief economist to the AFL CIO and is a professor in and former chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. Bit of Esmeralda Spalding. Well, home attendants who have worked as long as two decades for First Chinese Presbyterian Community Affairs Home Attendant Corp, caring for elderly and ill patients in their homes, were forced to work for what amounted to 24-hour shifts for as many as 7 days a week, but were paid for only 12 or 13 of those hours. The workers were also denied overtime pay, but they weren't taking it lying down. Joined by workers from the Chinese American Planning Council and other home care agencies, the FCP home attendants are demanding that FCP resolve their case immediately by giving them back their stolen wages. And they're headed to court to back up their demands. Let's join the Ain't I a Woman campaign of the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops, organizing the workers to realize their demands. To the picket line.
No more 24 hours! No more 24 hours! No more 24 hours!
We're here today because the home attendants who are employed by the First Chinese Presbyterian Community Affairs Home Attendant Corporation, right here in this building, the home attendants have filed a lawsuit against their employer because they have been working 24-hour shifts and only getting paid for half of that. Their patients are Medicaid patients who have been approved through a rigorous process to receive 24 hours of care. That means care day and night. And so these workers have been having to work 24 hours of work so that they can provide care for their patients. This is terrible for both the workers and the patients. And on top of it, the workers are not getting paid their fair share or the full amount of hours that they've been working. We're here today with the workers of the First Chinese Presbyterian, but there's also workers from all over, lots of different agencies, both in New York City and upstate, who have been facing the same conditions. We've come together as the Ain't I a Woman campaign because many of us are forced to work long hours. Many of us are caregivers in various capacities, and these conditions are just completely unacceptable. We're gonna start with our first speaker today, Elida Agostino, Mejía Herrera.
¿Cómo está? Soy Elida. Trabajé en First Chinese por 15 años como cuidadora en el hogar.
I worked at First Chinese for 15 years as a home attendant.
Por 15 años. La mayoría del tiempo trabajé 120 horas por semana, pero ellos pagaron por solo la mitad de esta hora.
For the majority of the time, I worked 120 hours per week, but they only paid me for about half that time.
Trabajamos muy duro para esto, pero estamos robados de nuestro pago. Por eso nos juntamos y demostramos y demandamos a First Chinese para nuestro pago robado. No es justo. Nos han robado tanto. No es justo. Nos han robado mucho tiempo.
We work hard, but they only are stealing our pay. For this reason, we came together to sue First Chinese Presbyterian for our stolen wages. It's not just, it's not fair that we work so hard and they steal our wages.
Hemos trabajado mucho para no ser pagado.
We work hard and then not getting paid.
Thank you, Elida. Sorry, next we have Alvaro Ramirez Guzman.
Buen día, mi nombre es Álvaro Ramírez Guzmán. Trabajé por 5 años, turno 24 horas. Siempre decían que pagaban las 24, pero nunca la pagaron. Todo ese dinero atrasado, esperamos que lo devuelvan. Dicen que 24 horas se duerme, no se duerme, porque hay que estar detrás del paciente con la medicina, el cambio de pamper y las 24 horas detrás de ellos. O sea que es mentira todo.
My name is Alvaro Ramirez Herrera. I work for First Chinese Presbyterian. I worked as many as 96 hours a week and working hard. We had to change the pampers of the patients. We had to take them, give them medicine. We had to take them to the bathroom. We could not sleep. It's a lie that we could sleep. We worked hard for this. We should be paid.
También 24 horas, siempre dice pagan 16, pero no pagan, no hay mucho dinero atrasado y eso esperamos esa recompensa. Y por mucho la unión hace la fuerza y esperamos que se unan más en esto.
So we work these 24 hours, but they say they pay us some, but it's not true. We need to be paid for all the hours that we worked. We want our old wages from all the work that we did before. And we want everybody, others, to join us.
Okay, gracias. Esperamos respuesta y que todo se solucione.
Thank you, and I hope that we can be strong and resolve this.
Queremos nuestro pago por sobre tiempo. Queremos nuestro pago por sobre tiempo.
Como yo, somos.
Como me.
Somos yo.
Siéntate.
Next we have Leticia Panama Rivas.
Bueno, lo que le quiero decir que First Chinese tiene trabajando gente 24 horas y muchas compañeras, como en mi caso, nos hemos lastimado en el trabajo. Sufrimos estrés porque tenemos que hacer muchas cosas por esos pacientes de las cuales solo pagan 13 horas y el resto de las horas no la pagan. Entonces, si usted trabaja 24 horas, de las cuales le paga 13, entonces el resto de las horas, que son como 11 horas, que supuestamente ellos no la pagan porque 8 horas son de descanso, supuestamente que uno duerme y las otras 3 horas son del break. Dígame, si a ese paciente le pasa algo en la noche, ¿contra quién se van a ir? Contra la home attendant. Y no solo por la home attendant, por muchos trabajadores que están siendo explotados a nivel nacional, y queremos que esto pague y nos paguen las horas que nos debe, que son las 24 horas que por regla que el gobierno exige que nos paguen y nosotras también tenemos que hacer valer nuestros derechos. Gracias.
I work for First Chinese working 24-hour shifts and we work very hard. I got for all these hours of working and all the stress, I got injured and there are a lot of people like me. But it's not fair. We work these 24-hour shifts and they only pay like 13 hours. They say supposedly that the other hours are for resting. But if we rest and something happens to the patient, then who's going to be held responsible? Us, the home attendant. We've got to come together, we've got to say to the government, you've got to pay us for all the hours that we work. Thank you.
Thank you, Leticia.
Páguenos nuestro overtime. Páguenos nuestro overtime. Páguenos nuestro overtime.
Pay the workers now. First Chinese. Pay the workers now. First Chinese.
Next we have Virtudes Duran.
Mi nombre es Virtudes Duran. Trabajé por 17 años en la Fachaní. Trabajé 24 horas todo mi tiempo. Trabajaba 24 horas por 4 días. Primero trabajaba 5 días, 8 y 7 días, pero después me pusieron a trabajar 4 días, 24 horas, por siempre, por 17 años. Y yo quiero que me paguen mi dinero que me tienen, que perdí en todo ese tiempo. Gracias.
My name is Victoria Duran, and I'm here because I worked for 17 years at First Chinese. I worked very hard, 24-hour shifts, some 4 days a week, and before even 5 days, even 7 days a week. I'm here because I want my pay for all those hours worked. They gotta pay us now.
Thank you. I'll just wrap up by saying that the work that the home attendants have been doing is hard, intense, incredibly stressful, and to only get paid for part of that time is ridiculous. And we demand that First Chinese Presbyterian pay their workers. And also, when the workers have asked for less than 24-hour shifts, they have been told, given very few hours, then not being able to make a living off of that. So basically they're forced into 24-hour shifts, which is absurd, and then to not get paid for them is absolutely absurd. Thank you for coming out today.
Pay the workers now! First Chinese! Pay the workers now! First Chinese! Pay the workers now! First Chinese!
And Ain't I a Woman, the Ain't I a Woman campaign of the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops, organizing workers to demand their rights. Give them those wages back. Support these home care attendants. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.